Welcome to the program Mountains and Valleys in the Spiritual Life with Father Benedict Groeschel. And now, Father Groeschel.
Hello, I'm Father Benedict Groeschel of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal in the South Bronx. And this is our seventh segment in our series, Mountains and Valleys on the Spiritual Journey. And today, our topic is the highest mountain, the pinnacle, the highest level of the spiritual life that anyone can aspire to in this world. Now, let me say before we begin that necessarily this segment has to be a failure. Eye has not seen, ear has not heard. It has not entered into the human mind to think of what God has prepared for those who love Him. Those who have arrived at a very high level of the spiritual life in this world are usually very quiet people, even if they are preachers or teachers or people of great accomplishment like St. Teresa of Avila, St. Catherine of Siena. When they get this far, they don't say very much. And scattered around, I'm sure, someplace even listening to this broadcast, there are a few very quiet, simple, chosen souls who live in the vestibule of eternity. For the rest of us plodders, as we say in New York, for the rest of us schleps, we're going to try to talk about this highest experience. Not that I think you should pretend that you are there. That would be presumption. Not that you would decide to get there today. What you better decide is to take the next good step that's right in front of you. That's what you better decide. And I don't want to be held responsible for distracting you on your spiritual journey by telling you too much of what's ahead, because some people might get so preoccupied by that they forget to do the tasks that are at hand. First things first. But it is always good for any of us to know something about where we are going, something about what is ahead. And even if we have to take a long, painful journey to get there in this world, or even in that mysterious purgation which exists after this world, we should know where we're going. And by the way, I think it's important to say that this purgation in no way implies that the salvation and grace won for us by our Lord Jesus Christ in His life, His death, and resurrection was inadequate. He alone does this. I'm not speaking about in any way meriting this. I'm talking about getting yourself prepared, the long journey, to prepare yourself to receive the fullness of God. In fact, you see how long it took our Lord to try to prepare the apostles, and they weren't too well prepared when Good Friday came. You read the Pauline epistles and the Johannine epistles. They are epistles about what to do to constantly prepare yourself. And the best description we have of that highest stage of the spiritual life is to be found in the 14th to the 18th chapter of the Gospel of St. John. You could read those four or five chapters over and over again for the rest of your life, and you would still find new mysteries. You would, as St. Paul says, pass from glory to glory, on and on. It's worth also mentioning that the great spiritual writers maintain that there is no highest level. This is a ladder without a top rung. It is, as St. Augustine says in the end of the Confessions, the seventh day of creation. It has a sunrise, but it has no sunset. There is no ultimate, utter limit of what we can do to to enter into the transforming union with God, either in this world or in the next, for all eternity, mysteriously, and you and I cannot understand this at all, we will be passing from one splendor to another. That's why it's very necessary to work on being a good Christian and following the way of Christ. What shall a man give in return for his soul? Now, the best analogy that is used, the best comparison of the highest state of the spiritual life is a high mountain. St. Augustine says, we take the spiritual journey to an interior Mount Sinai. St. John of the Cross uses the example of an interior Mount Carmel. In the life of St. Francis, who was not an intellectual writer like John and Augustine, he used the concrete example of a mountain, Mount Alvernia, a very high and awesome mountain in the Apennines, where he would go and pray for months at a time, living in a cave. This is the high mountain. Now, my favorite mountain, my favorite example of it, is the very, very beautiful mountain in the Holy Land called now Mount Tabor. Some people say they're not sure that this is the mountain on which Jesus was transfigured. I'll tell you, if you ever saw it, you wouldn't doubt. Now, are there some descriptions of what this highest life is like? Well, yes. We find a very beautiful one in Ephesians 3. And I'm going to really work on this text. In Ephesians 3, we find St. Paul speaking, I think, from his own experience of this highest life. You know, he alludes to that different times. I knew a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I know not. He's speaking about the highest levels of God when he says he was drawn up to the fifth heaven. He was drawn up beyond this world. Now, St. Paul here in Ephesians 3 writes, for this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven or on earth is named, that he may grant you in accord with the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner self, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the holy ones what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ which surpasses all knowledge, so that you may be filled with the goodness of God. Now to him who is able to accomplish far more than we ask or imagine, by the power at work within us, to him be glory in the Church of Jesus Christ to all generations forever and ever. Now, let's take that text apart. Let's see if we can find in this text some idea of what a person at the higher level of the spiritual life might know. Remember, I've used the analogy of a mountain. I was working on this talk out in Colorado, and behind the beautiful St. Malo Retreat House is a very marvelous, symmetrical mountain. Just reaches up beautifully. It's like everybody's idea of a mountain. And even in the hot summer, there was still snow up in the gorges in the mountain. They told me it took 8 hours to climb that mountain, if you're in good health. I never even started. But I couldn't believe it was 8 hours. It didn't look that far. But that's because I was some distance from it. And I finally went over one afternoon in my sandals, not attempting to do any mountain climbing, and I just came up a few hundred feet of the mountain, and the richness of what seemed so plain in the distance was now revealed to me. Crags, little valleys, ridges, little cliffs, huge boulders, beautiful little plateaus. That's what the spiritual life is like. And when you get to the top of the mountain, if you've ever climbed the mountain, there's the exhilaration, the marvelous experience of looking 360 degrees around for miles and miles, the high mountain. And then you look up, and there's the sky, the mysterious, infinite sky. You feel like you can reach out and touch it. The spiritual life is a mountain that does not have a top. There is no ultimate summit. You keep climbing over, and you climb into infinity. Now, what is this like? Well, St. Paul speaks about it here in Ephesians. He has just said it. I pulled my marker out. He's just said it, and let's take a look at some of these things. That you may have the riches of his glory. And this is what you see when you see a person at this level praying quietly through the Spirit in the inner self. These people don't need anything else. We used to have a very holy layman stay with us sometime. His name was Frank Sheed. He was a spiritual writer, published books with his wife in a company called Sheed and Ward. Oh, he was 83 years old at the time he stayed with us. And he had written dozens of spiritual books. His entire life, all that he ever made, was put into the publication of excellent spiritual books. He died with just a few thousand dollars to his name, having been a most successful publisher, because he gave everything away and invested everything in publishing. Wonderful man. And I came by one day, and he was sitting in a room just like this. Wasn't doing anything, wasn't reading anything, wasn't saying anything. And I came by and I said the stupidest thing I've ever said in my whole life to a man who had published thousands of spiritual books. I saw him sitting there and I said, "Oh, Frank, can I get you something to read?" Dumbest thing I ever said. And very peacefully he looked at me and he said, "Why, no, I've read it all." What he was reading then is not written on the pages of books. What he was reading then were the secrets of the mystery of God revealed to the inner person. I would love, on the last day of my life, to be able to say quietly, "I've read it all." And then, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you may have the strength to comprehend the breadth, the length, the heights, and depth of God. Now, this is something that is not given in books. The comprehension of God, can we say it? The comprehension of the incomprehensible, the grasping of the ungraspable, the understanding of the utterly mysterious. What is St. Paul saying there? He obviously is meaning something partial. But it's partial now, not because the holy ones that he speaks about are putting obstacles in the way of God, or being distracted, or being involved in all kinds of unimportant things. He's saying that it is partial because God is infinite. But the divine light is flowing into the soul. Brothers and sisters, when I think about that, I say to myself, what did I ever waste my time on anything else for? What do I care that I have critics? What do I care what people say about me? And some people say some fairly nasty things. They don't know, they don't understand we and the brothers and sisters of our community are trying to do. They take it as an affront, a criticism. What do I care? Somebody writes me a letter right on EWTN and tells me, oh, you're going to hell. What do I care? I get such letters. What difference does it make? When the martyrs were taken out to be killed, it didn't make much difference to them. St. Thomas More said to the axeman, help me up, I'll get down myself after you've got my head off. What difference does it make? The jailer that took St. Thomas More out of his jail cell to bring him to execution said he acted like he was going to a wedding. Of course, because these people had some knowledge of what is to come. St. Thomas More, when he was awaiting execution, wrote this prayer, give me the grace, dear Lord, to fix my heart firmly on you and not to hang on the blast of men's mouths. To buy away the past by the sufferings of the future, to cry out pitifully for my sins, to keep the last things before my eyes, which are always at hand, and to know that if I had these attitudes, they would be of more value than all treasures of all kings and princes, Christian and heathen, if they were piled up in one big heap. That's the prayer of St. Thomas More as he waits for death. Now, there's some specific things that people like this, that we can say about them. Father Dubé, in the book which I mentioned to you already in this series, The Fire Within, says this of a person who has gotten this close to God. The transforming union, the pinnacle of human maturity, occurs when the person is divested of all that is not divine, of all that is creature-centered. To put it positively, this culmination happens when one is wholly in love with God. Wholly, not just mostly. All things of both God and the soul become one in particular transformation, and the soul appears to be God more than a soul. Indeed, it is God by participation. These are the words of St. John of the Cross. And Father Dubé points out this is not pantheism, for truly its being, even though transformed, says St. John of the Cross, is naturally as distinct from God as it was before. This is a union of two beings because of their likeness to each other. St. Paul uses the analogy of the marriage of Christ to the church. And he says that we should be married to God. Now, for us ordinary slobs, what does it mean to be married to God? St. John of the Cross speaks about this. And he says it is a union of two things because of their likeness to each other. What is the likeness? The likeness is holiness. God in himself is holy. He defines what holiness is. It is him. And this poor little human soul, born with original sin, saved and sanctified by the grace of Christ, purified by the providence of God and his goodness, through darkness and light, this soul is now, as St. John of the Cross says, like a glass window, cleansed from all imperfections and dirt. It is a glass window that has become just like the sunlight that goes through it. It's perfectly clean. If you've ever looked at a window that's clean because the sun is coming through it and all imperfections are removed, you can't tell the difference between the window and the sunlight coming through it. Now, what do people who are in this level act like? Well, first of all, they are filled with the delight of God's presence. It's not just a feeling. They are there with God. When you're dealing with them, you realize, as I have said before, that Christ is dwelling in them, that he operates through them. Did you ever look at the rest of us Christians? And if you're a non-Christian and you happen to be watching this program, you're probably saying to you, this sounds all beautiful, but I met all these Christians, and they don't act like that. That's true. The biggest obstacle to Christianity, Mahatma Gandhi used to say, are the Christians. He used to say, when somebody asked him, what do you think about Christianity? He says, it's a wonderful idea. They should try it. Because we do not do the works of Christ. We do all kinds of other works. But if you meet somebody sometime and you have this feeling, you know, why it's like dealing with Jesus. Then you are dealing with someone who has been transformed. Now, there's another little group of people who pretend to be Jesus. They're basically amusing. They remind me of little children in nativity plays who are pretending to be angels. They have little sticks stuck in their shirt with little halos on top and paper wings attached. Those are phony Jesuses. At best, they're amusing. At worst, they're an obstacle to the gospel. But once in a rare while, usually in the back of the church, usually not attracting so much attention, you meet these holy souls in whom the presence of Jesus shines forth. Maybe it wasn't always that way. It probably wasn't. They've had to overcome a lot of bad habits. Maybe when we meet them, we don't realize how much progress they made because we're still thinking of them as they were. But these people are filled with a delight in the presence of Jesus Christ. In our next segment, I'm going to talk about some of the helps that God gives us to get us there. All that I will say to you now is when you hear about this holy life and you look at it, recognize it is the most precious possession in the world. And if you know such people, I guarantee you that the rest of the world is going to bypass them or think that they're stupid or think that they're not going, don't know what's going on. And they have their faults. They're only human beings. They have their shortcomings. When I studied the life of Cardinal Cook, who I mentioned in the last segment, I was aware of many people who had criticized him, who had laughed at him, who belittled him, who patronized him. He couldn't care less. He had his shortcomings, his limitations. He hated controversy. He found it very, very difficult to challenge someone. He almost never, ever lost his composure. He's always very patient. The one time I could find in public where he lost his composure, it was where the newspapers had really committed blasphemy. They had mocked the holy things of God, and he really got angry. And the people at the press conference were thunderstruck. They never saw him that way, and he got up and walked out. But ordinarily, he wasn't like that. So people took him for granted. But you know, he was somewhere else. And this is why when a most painful death came upon him, he called it this grace-filled time. I mention Cardinal Cook because he was a public figure. As a rule, the saints of God are not public figures. They're known to no one but God. However, you could do yourself a big favor if you're like me, a straggler on the road, if you meet one of them and spend some time looking at what they are like. I used to be an altar boy for the servant of God, Father Solanus Casey, the most unobtrusive person in the world. I used to eat lunch with a man who was a bloodless martyr, Bishop James Walsh of Mary Knoll, who had spent 23 years in prison for the crime of being a Christian. He was the most unobtrusive person. These people aren't being humble. They're drawn beyond all of the things, the nonsense that you and I think is important. There was a man who, when he was just about 39 years old, wrote this prayer. When he wrote it, he was a minister of the Anglican Church, John Henry Newman. And now he is, as Cardinal Newman, being proposed for beatification. I'd like to end this program on holiness with this prayer, because these were the sentiments that guided Newman on his long and painful life. To holiness. Oh, that we could take that simple view of things as to feel that one thing lies before us, and that is to please God. What gain is it to please the world, to please the great, even to please those whom we want to love, compared with this? What gain is it to be applauded, admired, courted, followed, compared with this one aim, to please God?